Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is John Sills, author of The Human Experience, How to Make Life Better for Your Customers and Create a More Successful Organization. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection in invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today we welcome John Sills to talk about his book, The Human Experience, How to Make Life Better for Your Customers and Create a More Successful Organization, published by Bloomsbury Business. After starting his career at a market stall in Essex, John Sills has spent the last 25 years working in and with companies around the world to make things better for customers. He's advised organizations such as Sky, The Body Shop, OVO Energy, Invesco, Morrisons, eBay, and UNICEF. Now managing partner at customer-led growth company The Foundation, John also spent 12 years at HSBC, starting on the front line and finishing as head of customer innovation. HSBC is a bank. John works closely with Young Enterprise, a charity that helps young adults become the next generation of entrepreneurs, and is a mentor for the School of Marketing. His writing has been featured in The Guardian, Management Today, and WARC, as well as having work exhibited at the Imperial War Museum, the Foundling Museum, and as part of the Bloomsbury Festival. And, interesting fact, he is an award-winning model. John, congratulations on The Human Experience and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Well, thank you. I mean, I have to say, I don't think my career could top the modeling competition I won when I was 2 years old. I think everything else has just been trying to reach those heights again. But I'm really glad you mentioned that.
Well, yeah, and it's I know it's a struggle to peak so early in life. So you actually won a modeling competition when you were 2 years old?
Do you know actually the worst part about this? I did. I won a modeling competition called the Clacton-on-Sea Bonnie Baby Competition. And it's kind of family legend. There were 29 little girls and me, and I won. And this is a source of huge pride. And then I found out about a year ago that the judge of that modeling competition was my godfather's cousin. So I suddenly realized that perhaps I didn't actually win because of my dashing babyish good looks, and it was all a big early taste of nepotism in the world.
You know, John, you have to go for whatever advantage you have. And people can go to this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com and see that you are, in fact, still not an unattractive man. You're a good-looking guy, like so many of the Marketing Book Podcast listeners. So your book is The Human Experience, and I just have to ask, is your favorite band the English synth pop band The Human League?
I'm only human. It's a great track. It's a great track. It's a great band. I think I'm trying to collect songs and bands that have just got Human in their title now. I did actually want to just call the book Human, but my publisher said that's probably a bit grand, and I think that title's been used a bit too. That title's been used a bit too much already. So,
well, maybe the next one. Yeah, but that could, you know, when you give these keynotes around the world, that could be one of your walk-on songs. You know?
Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah, there's no charge for these ideas, John. You know,
I'm noting them all down. As
yeah.
Well, right?
Yeah.
Maybe, so, maybe my next modeling competition.
Yeah. You know, you got to keep your options open. And as they say, John, you have to have diversified revenue streams. So,
yeah.
Now, I saw that the book is endorsed by Rory Sutherland, the vice chairman at Ogilvy, UK. And I interviewed him a few years ago about his alchemy book. Ah, oh, what a book. You know, when I see that he's like on a cover or he's endorsed it, I just can't. I can't resist. I have to start looking at the book, and I've read some other had some other books on the show recently where he wrote the foreword. Just phenomenal. Let me read what he wrote. He writes, and I'll read it in my accent. I won't try and impersonate Rory. No one can do that. Even though Britain proudly claims to be a service economy, most transactions with business and government seem designed entirely around the convenience of the service provider, not the value to the consumer. We really do need a Copernican revolution in both government and commerce to overcome this wasteful misalignment of effort. And this revelatory book will tell you exactly where to start. And, you know, your book is about the human experience. Human, I feel liberated because I want to mention that in the acknowledgments, one of the people that you mentioned is your dear mother who passed away just before this book was published, and sorry to hear about that. And you write, you were mad as a hatter, but gave everything you had to help us on our way. I think that's great. And then you also mention a final word of thanks to my wonderful Nan, who, when she was 101 years old, gave me her two bits of wisdom for a long and happy life, which I will pass on to you now. And listener, if you don't listen to anything else, this is probably the most important thing you're going to hear in this interview. Number one, drink whiskey every day. Number two, laugh at the world.
Yeah, and I think they have to be in that order, because I think drinking whiskey every day then really, really helps you to laugh at the world in a much better way, I find.
Yeah.
If you get through it.
Yes, and I've done a lot of research on that, so it really appealed to me. And I just saw that and I thought, how can you not like Nan? You know,
this is it. She was a wonderful, wonderful woman. I was with my mum. I had to get my sister's permission to write that my mum was mad as a hatter, but my sister was happy with that. But you know, my nan was just one of these incredible women that had kind of lived through two wars, lived through the Blitz, stayed in London, you know, owned a pub, had done all kinds of jobs, you know, retired for a very long time, but was just happy every single day, just funny every single day. And yeah, I remember asking her about that advice. And it just made so much sense. I actually bought her some. Whiskey and some jams for her 100th birthday, actually. And I went round her house about 6 months later, and all the whiskey had gone. all the jams were still there. And she said to me, she said, "Oh, John, do you want some jams?" She said, "Someone bought them for me. I can't remember who, but they're horrible. I don't want those.
Yeah,
take them away.
Can you take the jam and just bring me some more whiskey?" Oh man.
Exactly.
Oh gosh, how can you not love a grandmother like that? So
yeah.
Well, God bless your mom and your grandmother. I want to read from page 15 where you write, "Ultimately, the only thing that really matters is how you make people feel. Companies should be there to help make life as easy and enjoyable as possible, not to create extra worry, stress, and wasted time and energy for people who'd rather be watching Netflix, going for long walks, or even spending quality time with their families. Increasingly, this humanity seems to be pushed to one side in favor of the illusion of efficiency. Yet, in reality, investing time and effort in creating a human customer experience will in turn lead to a more efficient organization, not just happier customers who will instinctively buy and recommend more, or a stronger brand that will be more attractive to potential customers, but a reduction in costs through fewer calls, fewer surveys, fewer errors, fewer complaints, and the vastly reduced attrition of employees. Therefore, in this book, I'll argue that restoring humanity to customer experience, balancing the human and the functional experience is better for both customers and business. And as someone who's read the book, you do that extremely well. Now, I want to jump to a page just beforehand and talk about The Wizard of Oz.
Just because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart.
So you write about how the Tin Man, that's who that was,
yeah,
a well-mannered, well-functioning chap who could, with some regular oiling, make his way along the yellow brick road. While the Tin Man was able to get to where he wanted to go, he was miserable. He didn't have the one thing that would have made him, and I'd imagine his venturing companions, truly happy, a heart. Many companies and customer experiences nowadays have something of that Tin Man feel about them. Explain.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's two things with this, and the last thing I'll share is how actually that ended up being quite controversial. But yeah, this started for me about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was on holiday in the UK, and I was with my wife and my son, and we were on a day out on one of these kind of beautiful old steam trains, and you'll probably know the kind I mean, like big deep leather seats that you could fall back into, and a nice big oak paneled table you could spread your food out on, and
sort of an Orient Express vibe.
Yeah, exactly. You know, someone coming down and handing out nice food for you to eat on your table with a knife and fork. And my son said to me, Daddy, is this what it's like when you get the train into London every day for work? and I kind of stopped and laughed, and my wife laughed, and I said, well, no, I mean, it's emphatically nothing like this. I'm lucky to get a stranger's sweaty armpit and a cold, wet panini handed out to me if I'm lucky. And
not to brag.
Yeah, not to, well, exactly. Not everyone gets the cold, wet panini. Yeah, some people, it's a sausage roll. In fact, I did go on a train once, and they did do a special announcement that they'd run out of quiche. And I always thought that was interesting that was deemed really important.
Yeah, and I'm sure that was the last straw for you.
That was it. There was no quiche on this service because of a delay in Newcastle. But yeah, it got me thinking really about, you know, we've had all this incredible technology in the past 20 years to help improve customer experience. And, but the sign of progress, the sign of real progress is to make things more efficient and better in a way that keeps the level of quality at least the same, if not improving it. And more, when you look around organizations and you look around customer relationships, it feels like all of this new technology has come in and there's been great strides in some elements of customer experience. But actually, I'm not sure things have got better. In fact, I think things have got worse. In fact, I know things have got worse because the data shows it. The satisfaction data in the UK hasn't budged. There's a fantastic thing in the US called the National Rage Survey in 1972. It was a White House study, actually, and 36% of people had a problem with a company that year. By 2016, that was up to 66%. By 2022, it's gone up to, I think, 72 or 73% now. So there's a clear decline in the relationships that customers are having, even though we've had all of this new technology. And yeah, so I think that is that, you know, organizations are focusing on this functional experience, but we've lost this emotional connection, this human connection that's left organizations full of humans that aren't allowed to act in a human way. The reason it ended up being slightly controversial is because I said this is just like the Tin Man. You know, he had everything he needed, he could walk along the road, he was functionally fine, but he didn't have a heart. And then my wife pointed out, oh yeah, but at the end it turns out that he doesn't need a heart. It turns out he's got everything he already needs, which kind of ruined the analogy just slightly. But then I kind of argued it back around that said, well, I think organizations have got everything they need because they've got humans in them that can act in a human way. They don't actually need anything extra, they just need to let the humans they've got be the human selves that they are. So that's where the link to the Tin Man came in, and I think it still stands up despite the criticism from my partner.
The tinsmith forgot to give me a heart.
So the book is very neatly organized into 3 myths, 7 behaviors, and 5 enablers. And of course, whenever I hear the word enabler, it makes me think of all my many alcoholic friends and family members.
I'm not an alcoholic. I just need a room dedicated to booze.
But I digress. So let's talk about the myths in your book. And in answer to the listener's unasked question. I know these people pretty well. One of the myths is not about the moon landing, because that's just too obvious a myth. Yeah. Let's talk about the first one, though. These are real myths. Very, very important. The myth of customer loyalty. We're going to hurt some feelings here. You realize that, John? But yeah. Why is that a myth? Explain.
Yeah, so this is probably the one, since the book came out, so it came out in the UK in February and in the US in April and in Australia in May. Since the book came out in the UK in February, this is the one I've probably had the most feedback on, shall we say. I mean, that makes it sound like hundreds of emails. I mean, it's about three emails and one was from my sister. But I think what we see at the moment is organizations and leaders in organizations talk about customer loyalty. You know, they talk about customers being loyal to them and how can they build customer loyalty. And I just don't believe that customer loyalty even exists as a principle. I think what you're really talking about is usefulness. So I used to have a taxi company. I used to use a taxi company where I lived, and they were fine, good cars, low prices. You could pre-book, but you couldn't pay by card. You know, you didn't know where the car was. And then Uber turned up, and all of a sudden I could pay by card, and I knew where the car was. So I started using Uber. But then about a year later, my local taxi company bought out their own app. And now I had a local taxi company that had good prices that I could pre-book, that I could use my card on, and that I knew where the car was. So I just stopped using Uber again. And that's not about loyalty. It's about, you know, you just have to stay more useful to your customers than your nearest competitors and alternatives. Now, where you do see loyalty is with people, friends, family, communities, for example.
Sure.
You know, and that's where you might see if a sports team's in trouble, for example, you might see people in the community out with buckets collecting money or raising money to build a roof on a church, for example. You don't see that with some of the companies we've seen disappear from our high street recently. Now, the reason this matters, because some people would argue that this is semantics, that I'm talking about usefulness, and that customer loyalty is used as a shorthand internally to describe this usefulness. But the problem is, words really matter. And if leaders in organizations believe that customers are loyal, then they stop trying to impress them. They focus on onboarding, they focus on acquisition, they focus on winning customers and marketing and bringing those customers in, and that's really, really crucial. But then they stop trying. They stop trying to keep the relationship. It's like, you know, having great first dates with your partner, you know, being the perfect partner all the way up until you get married. And then as soon as you get married, you know, you let yourself gain weight and you stop going out on dates and everything else that happens in the relationship with us. That's exactly what we see in organizations. And that's why I think it's important to challenge the concept of loyalty in the way that it's currently used.
Yes. Well, let's not spoil it for all those unmarried people about what's ahead in life. But, you know, there was a book on the show quite recently by Alan Adamson called Seeing the How. And in that book, it had to do with, you know, understanding your customers better, which you talk about in chapter 15, which I want to get to. It was my favorite chapter. And he talks about how at one point years ago, they were researching people for a chain of pizza restaurants in the United States. And all these people seemed to have a lot of loyalty. They were saying, "Oh, that's great. We like this place. They're very nice. They're very friendly." And they just weren't really getting very good insights. And finally, someone said, "Well," they were mistaking it for loyalty. And they said, "Well, what would happen if the chain went away?" And without skipping a beat, they'd say, "Oh, we'd go to the one down the street. No problem. We like them."
Well, it's exactly right. You know, if any of your listeners are listening and thinking that I'm wrong, I'd encourage all of your listeners to think about a company that they believe they're really loyal to. And then if you say, well, if overnight they tripled their prices and the quality reduced by half, would you still use them? Almost definitely not. Now, you might if the organization is psychologically or socially useful. So someone like an Apple or a Tesla, where the brand represents something about who you are, Patagonia, for example, you know, they might in that case still use them, even if price and product quality changed. But even then, that social and psychological usefulness can disappear. If you say, for example, you bought a Tesla or you thought you were loyal to Tesla, and say, for example, the owner of Tesla went to buy a massive social media company and started to show that he perhaps wasn't a particularly nice manager, and he was starting to challenge other business leaders to cage fights, you might start to think maybe Tesla isn't quite as socially useful as it used to be in the past. So even then, there's elements that come into it.
Yeah. And there's an author, of course, there have been hundreds on this podcast, but Bob Hoffman, the ad contrarian, and you may have heard of him. He's been on a number of times, and he talks about the same thing. A number of authors have, but this myth of customer loyalty. Of course, he does it with very salty language, which years ago required me to produce a listener advisory to air before the show in case they had children in the car. And he talks about, look, people want a reasonably priced product they can rely on, and they want to be left alone. They don't want the brand to make love to them. They don't want to have a relationship with the brand. So that's really a hard truth, and it's a very important one to make. Let's jump to the next one. The myth let me tie that up with a nice bow here. You're right. Customer loyalty is a myth. Staying useful is what matters. And if in doubt, and this is going to hurt some people's feelings, remember that nobody cares about your business as much as you do. Oh, no truer words, no truer words. The next one is the myth of customer feedback. And you talk about how we're living in an epidemic of feedback requests. But, you know, speaking of feedback, John Sills, can we just pause for a moment and let me know on a scale of 0 to 10, how do you think this interview is going? Don't answer that question. I'm sorry. But talk about this, the myth of customer feedback. This is, there have been whole books about this topic and the perils of bad customer feedback.
Yeah, this is my favorite topic, actually. You know, it's quite similar to the amount of technology that we're using at the moment. But, you know, we've never had more customer information coming into organizations. There's an absolute deluge of it. And as a customer, you can't have any experience now without immediately being asked to rate your experience and ask whether you would recommend that organization to someone else. And this is really useful. You have to do this. You have to find out about customers. But the problem is all of this feedback is at what I call the thin end of the wedge. So if you imagine your customer's life as this kind of wedge shape, this triangle shape on its side, at one end, you've got all the thing that really matters to them. You know, their real world, their real life, their hopes, dreams, ambitions, their friends, their family, their work, you know, the services they use to help them when they've got problems, the services they use to help them to do great things. And then right at the very end of that wedge, at the very thin end of the wedge, is you and your organization. But the problem is 99% of all of this customer data and research coming into organizations is at the thin end of the wedge. What do you think about us? What do you think about our service? What do you think about our products? Would you recommend us?
How great are we?
How great are we? Tell us how great are we? And the problem with this is all of this data coming into organizations, it convinces leaders that they're close to what matters to customers. Whereas in truth, they're only close to customers' opinions of their business. And that's a very subtle but a very significant difference. The best organizations, we call them customer pioneers, organizations that really trailblaze on behalf of their customers, they get up to the thick end of the wedge. They understand what really matters, what's really going on to customers in their lives, and how they can be most useful to them in their lives, not just this inside out spiral of what do you think about us. So it's not good for organizations because it tricks them into thinking they're close to what matters to customers and they're not. And it's really bad for customers because of Daniel Kahneman's PKM rule, the last bit of the experience is the thing that one of the things you remember the most. And at the moment, the last bit of all of our experience is being chased and hassled to give feedback when organizations could just look at the data they've already got and see how happy I am.
Related to this thin part of the wedge, you quote this Unilever executive who said, "People are only consumers for a few hours of the day. If you don't understand how to add value to hours of their day outside of being consumers, you run the risk of creating a brand that lacks staying power." And then on the next page, you quoted Terry Leahy, CEO of Tesco, writes, he said, "What creates loyalty is how much we understand your life and what we do about it that helps your life. If you don't have a vision as a retailer that you are doing this to understand customers better and deepen that relationship, you're always going to wonder why you're making the effort." Your section, your whole chapter on the myth of customer feedback also brought to mind the book Ogilvy on Advertising from the 1980s, which was one of two books that have had the biggest impact on my working life. And he talks about the same things, how people will often tell you what they think the researcher wants to hear. And there's a lot of leading questions. I mean, it's still a problem. Actually, you know what? It's probably even more of a problem now with all this survey fatigue that we have. So
Well, it's you know, even more than that, really, Douglas. And you mentioned chapter 15 that we'll come to in terms of staying connected to your customers. But I heard a fascinating story the other day about funerals. Actually, it's a guy I know that used to run one of the big funeral companies here in the UK, and he went in as managing director, and their customer service score was 98%. 98%, really, really high score. But he was very
like 98% meaning
happy, really happy. 98% out of 100 satisfaction. So wow. You know, really, really high satisfaction score. And the whole company were really proud of this. But he was a very experienced manager, and he thought that's really good. Like, you don't get those scores really. So he spent a bit of time, you know, immersing in the experience, and realized that, yeah, actually it wasn't quite as good. Anecdotally, he could tell it wasn't quite as good as he thought. Anyway, he put it to the back of his mind. And then a few months later, he was doing some other research where they got together a group of customers that had been arranging funerals maybe 6 months before. And he kept hearing the same phrase over and over again, which was, oh, if I'd known, I would have done it differently. Or I wish I'd known that at the time. And so he got those people to fill in, redo the survey that they did 6 months previously. And the score went down to 62%. And he called these people the secretly disappointed. Because, of course, if you've arranged a funeral or any big stressful moment, frankly, you know, and you get a survey straight afterwards and it says, how was it? You just go, it was great. Thank you. It was exactly what we wanted, exactly what they would have wanted. It was brilliant. Thank you so much for your help. Then you spend a bit of time reflecting, because in the lead up to something like a funeral, your brain is kind of full. You don't have a lot of cognitive space. Afterwards, you're just grateful. It's over, 10 out of 10 done. In the 6 months afterwards, you start reflecting and going, oh, do you know, if I'd really thought about it, I could have done it like that. Mm-hmm. Well, that could have been a bit more interesting. Or you hear other things. Oh, I didn't realize we could have driven past the sports ground on the way. He would have loved that. Or I didn't realize we could have had doves, et cetera, et cetera. And so he ended up completely redoing the way they did their kind of funeral planning with customers to make it far easier for them to make choices. He worked with the team on empathetic listening to really pick up on these small things that might make a difference, that the person wasn't in the mental frame at the time, the mental state at the time, to be able to really kind of take on and do something about. And he introduced this 6 month survey as a permanent thing, which over time went from 62% to 80%. But yeah, this principle of the secretly disappointed, I think, is just an example of how surveys are good to an extent, but people don't know how they behave. People don't know how they behave. So you have to observe people if you really want to understand what matters to people. It's not that they'll lie to you. They just will tell you what they think is true, even if it's not true.
Yeah. And I also wonder if they do that to get their time back. You know, I'll go on an airline flight, and sometimes a couple of years ago, I responded to one of these surveys and it went on and on. Of course, that was the last one I did, but I just thought, come on.
Yeah.
What do you, only to add to that, I don't really think they would have done anything differently. So that's that sounds like a very smart business person, that insight they had about the customer feedback. So really well done. So if you look at any kind of research study about, you know, what's keeping marketers up at night, what's the biggest challenge, very often you'll see at the top of the list, proving ROI.
Yeah.
So let's get to that third myth, in case there's still any listeners, because you obviously we're just upsetting people left and right here. Talk about the myth of ROI. I mean, come on, speak truth.
Yeah, I can't believe you don't think criticizing loyalty, telling people surveys about and talking about funerals isn't podcast gold dust. I mean, I would have thought people would be. Lovely,
well, if there are any listeners still listening, please reach out to us and let us know, and we'll send you a car, a new car. No, I'm kidding.
Specific Venn diagram. Yeah, ROI I think is really interesting. So I often get asked, you know, in my job I get asked, you know, prove the return on investment in a customer experience. You know, why should we make things better for customers? And there's all sorts of arguments. Why start? Some of that is just social and ethical. You know, you want to have a good impact on people's lives. But more than anything, you know, people often look at it the wrong way. They look at it in terms of how can we show that improving customer experience is going to make us money? Whereas in fact, bad customer experience is just really expensive to provide.
Mm-hmm.
A company called a Vanguard Consultancy many years ago came up with the principle of failure demand. Demands that are put onto your service as a result of you failing to do something the correct way the first time around. And for an example, we worked with an energy company recently. 30% of all the calls that were coming into their contact center were repeat phone calls because the customers weren't happy with how the call had been dealt with the first time. And you start to see this everywhere. You know, you start to see, you know, delivery slots dots. You start to see, you know, unexpectedly high call volumes. You know, you start to see email overload, all of these problems that come into organizations to deal with just because the experience hasn't been good enough, first of all. So the best business case for improving your customer's experience and your customer experience as an organization is that it will make you a more efficient, lower cost organization to run. And that's really the argument in the book.
Oh, so true. And sorry, I host this podcast where I interview authors, so I'm going to mention a couple other books. But there was another one that was on recently called The Effortless Organization by Bill Price. And he had worked at Amazon for many years. And in the book, amongst many brilliant things he talks about, is something similar to this, where he says, you know, rather than responding to these problems right off the bat, first ask, why are they calling in? there may be a problem. And then, and throughout the book, he mentioned about certain companies where they were reducing the size of their call center because they were able to engineer their customer experience such that it became more frictionless.
Yeah, so I think it's exactly that. We did a project with a company recently on empathy, and it was the wrong question to ask, because you don't need to train people how to be more empathetic. You just need to give people the opportunity to be more empathetic. And it was dealing with mortgages and home buying, and you could see straight away the people in the contact center when the call connects. You know, that first 30 seconds, the customer is just saying that script that they've pre-prepared, that's in their head, and that script tells you everything you need to know. But the person in the contact center is looking at all the screens in front of them with all the information popping up and missing all of that really important information that the customer is sharing. So, of course, they miss something, and as you say, the customer calls back. So I completely agree. I think that's brilliant, brilliant advice. Just listen to your customers and everything will be far easier.
Yes, and then you can start to see how the ROI it works from a cost saving standpoint. And I think I misspoke. The book is The Frictionless Organization, and that was episode 438. I'll include a link to that on this episode's website page at Marketing Book Podcast. So just to round this out, you're right. Instead of loyalty, organizations need to focus on usefulness. Instead of feedback surveys, on genuine understanding. Instead of ROI, on the cost of inaction. Oh, such great advice. Now, the book has recurring mentions from the following eight very successful organizations. I'll just mention them: AO.com, Bendigo Bank, Chiltern Railways, Citymapper, NHS Blood and Transplant, Octopus Energy, Riverford, and Workday. So if John mentions them, those are the ones that were very interestingly threaded through the book. I don't recall seeing that, where you say, look, these are the books, the companies I'm going to talk about, and then you mention them several times after you explained who they were in a very short chapter. So I appreciate the way you did that. So let's talk about some of these behaviors. And there are seven. And let me just state what the behaviors are, because we may not get to all of them. But John Sills, I noticed that they are also in alphabetical order. And when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, you notice really trivial things. So, you know, don't think you got past this reader. So they are accessible, consistent, flexible, proactive, respectful, responsible, and straightforward. Now, every one of those seven words could probably mean something different to everybody listening. So let me just jump in and maybe ask you a question or two about each one. Mm. And I'm going to go to page 55 for those playing the home game, and you quote Riverford Organic, which is a organic produce company, right?
That's right.
In the UK and France. Uh-huh. You write, this is from, I don't know, was it an internal document, I think, maybe?
Guy Singh Watson, who's the founder and co-owner.
Okay,
was me. I interviewed him.
And this is from your interview. Okay.
From an interview, yeah.
Okay. All right, so he said, if you do need to ring us, someone will pick up the phone and they'll know what they're talking about and they'll have the authority to make things better. People make it out to be expensive, but it's not as expensive as people think. You ring them up and get 10 options, then three more options, then put your account number in, then you get through and get told, we're too busy to answer, and you just think, fuck off. It's so disrespectful to customers. So talk about, you know, how are companies blowing it by being inaccessible? Now, there could mean a lot of different things, but you zero in on some things that they're being inaccessible, and it's really hurting their business.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and by the way, Guy's a brilliant person to interview, but like I think you mentioned about Ad Contrarian, he does swear in almost every single line, so to become quite difficult.
Fuck off!
Exactly, to become quite difficult. I think the accessible thing is actually one of the biggest things we've got a problem with at the moment. It just becomes really, really difficult to contact organisations. So you'll know this, any of your listeners will know this, when you get a do not reply email address, you know, organisation emails you or texts you, messages you from a do not reply email address. You know, nothing says we don't want to talk to our customers more than contacting them through an email address that you just can't reply to. And I talk about this in the book about imagining, again, like this was your partner in real life. Imagine your partner texting you or ringing you from a number, but you weren't allowed to contact them back. Or when you did, they'd be told, I'm sorry, I'm chatting to a load of other people at the moment. You can't speak to me.
Well, that would be fine with my wife. In fact, often when I text her, the response back is, how did you get this number?
Yeah, leave me alone. This is what we've got the court order for. Yeah, you see this in those kind of examples, but also just in terms of phone calls now, is organizations have tried to hope that chatbots become like these gatekeepers. An example for you, a few years ago when my mum was ill, actually, I had to ring up to find out if I was insured to drive her car. And I had to find out pretty quickly, like I needed to know there and then. And I rang up my insurance company and I pressed, you know, the little combination of numbers that I hope would get me through to someone, and it just said, you know, did you know you can do this online? And I thought, well, yeah, because it's 2023 and I know that the internet exists. I'm clearly phoning you for a reason. And then I tried another combination, didn't work, another combination. And every time when it said, did you know you could do this online, it was hanging up on me. And after 10, 15 minutes, I get through to someone and I said, look, I just need to know, can I drive my mum's car? And the first thing he says is, well, you know, this is in your policy document. And I said, well, I'm a normal human being. I don't carry my policy document around with me everywhere I go. And then he said, yes, you can drive your mum's car. And I thought that could have been an exceptional experience. That could have been, I phone up, they answer straight away. Within 10 seconds, I've got the answer and I'm on my way. But instead, it was 15 minutes of sheer frustration. So I think we're just, you know, it's madness when you think about it. 20 years ago, organizations wanted to speak to customers because that's how you build customer relationships. That's how you build customer relationships. If a customer wants to contact you as an organization, you've got to believe they're doing it for a reason. They're contacting you for a reason. So be there and help them. That's the quickest way to get it done and build a good relationship. But organizations increasingly inaccessible, you know, increasingly hard to actually, it's not just speak to someone, but get to someone, get the information you want. And that's causing real damage with customer relationships.
And it seems so surprising when I call an organization and I get a person.
Yeah. It's delightful, isn't it?
So let's jump to the next one. Consistency. Again, that means different things to different people, but you write that the customer reality matches the brand promise. Oh my goodness. That, again, there's been entire books on branding about that one sentence right there. The experience is the same however the customer chooses to interact. And then back to the analogy you had about you know, dating and then marriage, the whole relationship is as good as the start. So yeah, talk about some of that where the companies are just, I mean, you don't have a lot of examples, but you really zero in on where companies are getting it just painfully wrong.
Yeah, I think there's a wrong and a right here. I mean, so, you know, I've got two small kids and last year for a New Year's resolution, I thought it might be a good idea to take up meditation to help me with that situation. And so I downloaded one of those meditation apps and the product was really good. You know, I had these little video or audio clips I could listen to every morning if I wanted to. But what wasn't so good was the 10 emails that they sent me in the first week.
Oh, yes.
Asking me to like upgrade or do this or do that or 20% off. And it's a great example of that lack of consistency. The product and the purpose of the organization is doing one thing. The marketing team is doing another that isn't aligned. Now, conversely, when you look at consistency, so Octopus Energy, who, as you say, I talk about in the book, in the showcase, wonderful energy company that's now become the third biggest in the UK, only started in 2015, so it's really grown rapidly. They have this thing where they build a team of people for every 50,000 customers. So 50,000 customers, one team of people internally that looks after that 50,000. And every 50,000 customers they add another team of people. But that same team looks after those customers. So if you phone up, you're actually, you know, pretty likely to talk to either the same person or someone that knows knows the person you spoke to. And what it means is even in a big company, they're creating this small company feel of like being known in that group, people knowing who you are, you speaking to the same person. And it means that they're really consistent in their service that they're providing. It's probably the biggest problem we see at the moment is the experience falling between those gaps, and rather than it being consistent across. And ultimately, consistency builds certainty, and certainty is what makes customers happy.
Yes. Oh, that's interesting. And so that team probably owns a lot of the problems. I would think they have a lot of sway. So when they have a customer problem, they're able to go back to the operations folks, yeah, or whatever, and say, look, we need to address this issue. Not everything is going perfectly, as you talk about in the book. You say that there's this flaw where a lot of things will work if everything goes perfectly, but they rarely do.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. I think this is a really interesting. I think I called it the pit of despair. It was the last thing I'd say. It was the last thing I put in the book, actually, was this pit of despair.
Oh, and that was very early in the book, too.
Yeah. I came from another article I wrote just before the book was about to be published, and I thought, actually, I should go. Partly because we've become very digital in our experiences, there's kind of this inbuilt belief in technology that, if we build this digital process, it will work. Nothing can go wrong. Whereas in the past, I think, when things were less digital, there was an understanding of human fallibility, an understanding that errors occur. So you need to be really good at putting them right when things go wrong. Now it feels like because organizations don't believe things will go wrong because of this digital approach, that customers just fall into this pit of despair where things either go right or you fall into the pit and just it takes months to get an answer. No one in the organization knows what's going on. No one knows how to fix it. No one really understands how the system works. And it becomes really, really hard to get out of. And either you just kind of give up or you write to the CEO and hope you can circumnavigate the system somehow. But yeah, we're seeing that just so much at the moment. And frankly, if you just presume things will go wrong and set up to resolve them really well, there's so much evidence, as you will know, that if you deal with a problem really well as an organization, customers will end up liking you more than beforehand. So that's not new news, but I think organizations have forgotten how important that is.
This it's on page 15. It's such a great, it's a very simple drawing. It would be a great thing to put on the whiteboard, like right now, if you folks are at work, and just say, where are we? And what are we doing? Oh, it's great. It would get you, just thinking about this would go well. But I think it's important to realize that a lot of these things are set up in, PowerPoint slides, as if everything's going to go perfectly. So
yeah,
let's jump to flexible. And I'm sorry, but the next section brings to mind this scene that I'm going to play the audio of from the 1970 film Five Easy Pieces, starring Jack Nicholson. And what's happening is he's at a diner with these three traveling companions, and they're trying to order breakfast.
I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes, tomatoes instead, a cup of coffee, and wheat toast.
No substitution.
What do you mean, you don't have any tomatoes?
Only what's on the menu. You can have a number two, a plain omelet. It comes with cottage fries and rolls.
Yeah, I know what it comes with, but it's not what I want.
Well, I'll come back when you make up your mind.
Wait a minute. I have made up my mind. I'd like a plain omelet, no potatoes on the plate, a cup of coffee, and a side order of wheat toast.
I'm sorry, we don't have any side orders of toast. I'll give you an English muffin or a coffee roll.
What do you mean you don't make side orders of toast? You make sandwiches, don't you?
Would you like to talk to the manager?
Hey, Mac.
Shut up. You've got bread and a toaster of some kind?
I don't make the rules.
Okay, I'll make it as easy for you as I can. I'd like an omelet, plain, and a chicken salad sandwich on wheat toast. No mayonnaise, no butter, no lettuce, and a cup of coffee.
And number two, chicken salad sandwich. All the butter, the lettuce, the mayonnaise, and a cup of coffee. Anything else?
Yeah, now all you have to do is hold the chicken, bring me the toast, give me a check for the chicken salad sandwich, and you haven't broken any rules.
You want me to hold the chicken, huh?
I want you to hold it between your knees.
You see that sign, sir? Yes, you all have to leave. I'm not taking any more of your smartness and sarcasm.
You see this sign?
I feel like I have that experience all the time. Yeah. I don't throw everything off the table onto the floor, but talk about being flexible. What is what is hindering that, and what are companies doing to be able to make intelligent audibles, as they say in the American football world, where an employee is empowered to actually solve the problem for the customer?
Yeah, I love that clip. Actually, it brings back an experience from quite a few years ago. I was on a weekend away with some friends, and someone was trying to order a poached egg. And they didn't have poached egg on the menu. They had every other type of egg. And I remember my friend saying, "Can you get the chef out here?" And the chef comes out and he said, "You know, have you got a pan? Yeah. Have you got water? Yeah. Have you got an egg? Yeah. Well, I'll have a poached egg." And this kind of, I never realized at the time, maybe he was doing a parody of that, but exactly that situation. But yeah, like I think when it comes to being flexible, I think that's a brilliant example. It's about standing in front of the rules. You know, organizations now or people in organizations, I think, just don't feel they've got the permission to be human. They don't feel they've got the permission to just make the common sense decision. It's quite incredible because these are people that, you know, a couple of hours before they turned up to work would do that. You know, I talk in the book about a few different examples. There's a story of a yellow chair I bought that I won't go into now because it will take up half the podcast. But
yeah.
It's, you know, incredible struggle. But one of the examples I do.
I almost thought you were making that story up, and we won't go into it, but I really thought you were.
No. It's every single word of it is absolutely true. So that's a nice teaser for people to get the book. But it's the most remarkable experience I've ever had. One of the other ones in the book that I mentioned that I like is about the pizza place we went to.
Oh, Jamie Douglas. Yeah.
Jamie Douglas, yeah. Went to a pizza place and he had a voucher. He tried to use a 2-for-1 voucher. But the guy said, "Look, you can only use the voucher if you've booked the table over the phone and you've just walked in." And he refused to budge on this. So my friend went out of the restaurant, phoned the restaurant, looked at the guy through the window while he was speaking to him, booked a table for then, walked straight back in, sat down at his table and was allowed to use the voucher. And then it's just, you know, these examples of just, you know, a whole lack of common sense. And increasingly we're seeing this, whereas organizations that do this really well, and some of the ones that I talk about, just have this flexibility around them. You know, I talk a lot about Honest Burgers, the restaurant over the road from where we are in King's Cross in London. And I've got a slightly odd order. I like the vegan burger, the plant burger, because it's quite light, but I also really love bacon. So I ask for the vegan burger with real bacon on top.
You're just a walking contradiction, aren't you?
This is it. And I just think, well, I like it because it's lighter, but I love the bacon. And they love it. They love it. They start calling it my special and the usual, and they get other people to try it. And they're like, yeah, why not? You just want a lighter burger, but you like bacon, and go for it. It's so important. It doesn't even have to be that extreme, though. A lot of this is just that kind of computer says no, lack of common sense. And it's all things that the person giving that service knows, if they were an outside observer, that it's a ridiculous situation, but somehow it still happens.
Can you explain the concept of structured flexibility?
Yeah, I think that's it, because obviously one of the things when you're in a big organization, if you're going to get consistency that we were talking about before, you can't allow everyone just to do whatever they want. You know, you have to have some element of rules around that, some element of structure. And what I've always found that's worked well through my career is structure and flexibility, where essentially you have a framework. It's like freedom within a framework. You know, you have a framework within which things need to happen, but people are free to do it in the way that they want to do it within that. So one of my examples, I used to run a sales team, and you know, we needed a sales team to you know, open the account, and for the customer, we needed to get the customer signed up for internet banking, as it was at the time. We needed to get the customer to go and meet a financial advisor. We had 5 or 6 things that we wanted to happen with the customer when they first joined us. And if we were being far too structured about it, and we were saying all of this has to happen within the first appointment, and it just wasn't happening, because of course people don't work like that. Some people have 10 minutes, half an hour. Some people,
and they know what they want.
They know what they want.
Yeah,
you know. And so what we then said to our sales team was, okay, within the first 30 days of this customer being with us, you have to have done all of those things or talked to the customer about all of those things. But it's up to you if you do it across 1 appointment, 2, 3 appointments, over the phone, in person, email, however you want to do it, we don't mind. That's up to you. But the structure within which you're in is you've got 30 days and these are the things we need you to be talking about. But how you do it is completely up to you. And it transformed it. It transformed the sales team, and both satisfaction and sales went through the roof as a result.
That's great. Yeah, it seems like it's just understanding what the customer is trying to accomplish. You talk about the start point and where they want to go, and it's a different journey and a different tempo for every person. So let's jump to proactive. And that's on, I want to go to page 97. John Sills, what are the 8 seemingly inoffensive, overly polite words that annoy you more than any other in customer experience?
Yeah. Is there anything else I can help with?
Yeah. Now, what's wrong with that, John?
Yeah. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Except
the original thing, if the original problem I've had has been resolved. And that's the thing, is these kind of, like you say, inoffensive, overly polite words that are absolutely fine, but more often than not, 2 things have happened. Either I haven't been helped the first time, or the person hasn't really thought about the outcome. And what we find in organizations is, again, going back to this failure demand, they're very quick to try and get you off the phone if you're speaking to maybe the phone, or if on a chatbot, for example, on a web chat. Because they're targeted on average wait time. They're targeted on getting you off the phone as quickly as possible. And what that means is you might only have the specific question you've asked answered. If you're lucky, you get that answered. But you don't have the knowledge that the person on the other end of the phone has. So the question you might be asking might not even be the right question. You know, and what you really need to do is have people that have the ability to kind of step back, ask the bigger question. I'll give an example. I bought some tickets to the theatre for my wife for her birthday last year, because I'm a wonderful husband, and I think that's important to tell the world that I bought these tickets tickets for my wife.
It is, even though she didn't really need to provide that comment about the Tin Man.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. Despite that, I still bought the tickets for my wife. I went to see The Wizard of Oz. No, we didn't. But I was online trying to find out which were the best seats to sit in. And it's quite overwhelming. You know, you've got all these different seats to choose from. You're not quite sure. And so I decided I was going to phone up. And I phoned up and I got through to this lady. I think she was called Anne. And she was amazing, amazing. Straight away, she was like, okay, you're going to go and see Moulin Rouge. Is that right? And I was like, yeah. And she's like, okay, and roughly how much money have you got to spend? And I told her. And she said, okay. She said, so the thing about Moulin Rouge is it's got a very particular kind of stage. And you have different things coming on from different sides of the stage all the time. And there's a big elephant here. And this here and this here. So actually these seats aren't the best ones. If you sit in these ones, these are the seats that are going to enable you to get the best view of all the different things that happen, which isn't quite what the map shows you. And she gave me all this extra information of questions that I had no idea I would even have to ask, let alone know what to do with the answer. I was on the phone for 5 minutes. She made the sale. I probably spent more than I wanted to. It was a brilliant experience. It was much quicker than if I'd been on the website. And it was all because she'd really predicted what I was trying to find out using her own knowledge. She was really proactive in terms of the way she was dealing with me, not just reacting to my question, which is, which seat should I book? And she'd say, well, just go for the cheapest one, or just go for the one you can afford. It was a brilliant experience. And then when we got there, the seats were absolutely amazing. And I emailed afterwards, months later, after I'd done the original booking, to say thank you to her for that.
Yeah. And I hope you said, and I'm John Sills, and I kind of know what I'm talking about. So whatever you're paying her, double it. Yeah. Let me put a bow around that. Page 102, you write, proactive gives a sense of certainty, a trust that the company is looking out for your best interests, taking a weight off your mind. It not only gives confidence that they'll be there should something go wrong, but also that they'll be in touch should a better offer emerge, not leaving it to chance that you may or may not see an advert or notice a renewal coming up. It's like having a leaking roof, and you call up the roof company that you've worked with, and you say, my roof is leaking, and they say, well, we can't fix that, but is there anything else we can help you with? No.
Yeah.
Get a team out here with a tarp.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Or even worse, they turn up and they put some kind of sticky plaster over it, but you've not really dealt with the problem. You know, they've dealt with the symptom, but not the problem. You know?
Right. Oh. Well, let's jump to respect. You write, respect and humility are crucial human traits that seem to have gone missing in the past decade, more broadly in public discourse and more specifically in customer experience. Explain what you mean by being respectful and how organizations have kind of gone off the rails with this. You know, this is kind of a hard book to read because, it makes me a more difficult customer, right? It raises unrealistic expectations for any kind of purchase I'm trying to make. But also, every one of these things you talk about, I've experienced.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad in a way, because I suppose I deliberately wanted to write the book with stories that would make people nod along, smile a little bit, but maybe get a bit angry about as well. You know, I tend to end up being kind of a bit cathartic for people to either read it or to angrily email me and tell me, I've had this terrible experience and you're the person I'm gonna tell about it. I think the respect thing's so interesting. I phrased it someone the other day as we've kind of gone from the customer's always right to the customer's probably wrong and they're probably trying to put a fast one on us. This kind of relationship has really deteriorated, this lack of respect. And there's a number of ways of seeing that. It could be not a lack of understanding or time taken to understand how you might be receiving information or how you might be feeling. I in the book, I talk about a feedback survey I got. I had to take my mum to accident and emergency a couple of years ago in the hospital where she was. An hour after we left, I got a text message saying, thank you for your recent visit to accident and emergency. Would you recommend this to your friends and family if they needed similar treatment? Give us a score out of 10. So my strongest recommendation to any of your listeners, if they need emergency medical assistance, is to get to their nearest doctor or the nearest hospital, not go to the one I was with my mum, just because I happened to say it was good. So there's a lack of respect there for thinking about how you might emotionally be feeling at that moment.
Yeah, it's not a real considered purchase anyway.
It's not really. And now you, in fairness, if they'd sent a message and said, how was it? Were you satisfied? And if they'd send that message a few days later, that's more acceptable. Because that's okay. I kind of don't mind if they want to know. Look, you think
that would be great. Yeah.
That would be much different. But to send it an hour afterwards, when you're probably still, for whatever reason you've gone into accident and emergency, your emotions are probably still high.
Yeah.
And to ask if you'd recommend it just doesn't make much sense. So there's things like that.
Well,
but John, let
me interject. I think they do it in that particular timing because that's just about when the drugs are kicking in.
Yeah. So you're feeling wonderful. Well, it's like they're secretly disappointed at the funerals. You're like, yeah, great. I'm just happy to be home. But I think the respect we see the good companies do, it's partly about time as well, respecting people's time. I think organizations have lost a bit of that respect, and that might come through filling in surveys or being on hold, for example.
Your call is important to us.
Your call is very important to us, but we've got unexpectedly high call volumes for 3 years now. But Octopus Energy, again, do this brilliantly. There's a couple of things they do. I don't know if it's the same in the US, but if you have to submit a meter reading, if you have to phone up your energy company and tell them how much energy you've used on the little clock you've got outside the house, that's a really boring job that no one wants to do. But if you do that with Octopus, you get to spin this little digital wheel of fortune. And you might win some money. But they do this other thing, which is if you're on hold, if you phone up and you have to be on hold to them, the music that plays will be a song that was number one when you were 14 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know that holding on the phone is a waste of your time. And they want to show that they understand that by at least trying to personalize it, by at least trying to make it a song you might recognize and you might enjoy, because that's about the age that you first get into music, rather than just having, a advert playing or just some kind of, really badly audio music playing as well. It came from a brilliant thing they have called Friday Night Dinner, where they all jump on a call and they spun up this idea on this one call and it ended up being live within 2 weeks. It's a brilliant story of innovation. But more than anything, it just shows respect for the fact people are using their time, and if they do have to be on hold, you've got to try and make it as palatable as possible.
And it makes me wonder, if they're that disrespectful of their customers, how are they treating their employees? Probably worse.
Yeah, and there's a huge correlation between happy colleagues and happy customers.
Yes.
Funnily enough, on the actual writing of the book, obviously all of the companies, the eight companies you mentioned in the showcase, are all companies that give brilliant customer experience. And so I reached out to all of them and said, look, can I speak to the CEOs or CMOs about the book? All of these companies said yes, because, and I thought that was really interesting, that they were all really open to it. There were some other companies that I tried to get in touch with that I thought also gave good experiences, but not quite as good as these. And I thought, well, maybe I'll interview some of those. And interestingly, only one of those came back and said yes. And I thought, that's quite interesting, actually, that culturally they weren't up for talking about it and their customer experience wasn't as good. The companies where the CEOs were really happy to be open and transparent about what they do are also the companies that give the best experience. And I thought that's an interesting correlation.
Oh, that's very interesting. And there was a book that was just on by Tiffany Bova from Salesforce called The Experience Mindset, and they've done a lot of research. It just came out, and they're able to prove now that if you you all want to have a good, everyone wants to have a good customer experience, but if you're doing it at the expense of your employee experience, you are shooting yourself in the foot, and the upside revenue potential is much greater if you give a brief moment of thought to, okay, we want to do this for the customers. How is this going to affect the employees? Really, absolutely. Really interesting. So yeah, very true. So the next section is responsible, and dang it, John Sills, this one really got my blood boiling. This is the one that, seriously, this really got me. This is the one that typically gets me more upset. And I am so tired of organizations not owning up to their mistakes. I mean, the mistakes are going to happen. Just say, hey, you know, it was a mistake. That at this point, I would be willing to accept the following excuse from any organization when they've screwed up. And it's a clip from one of the greatest movies in film history, which is not The Wizard of Oz. It's Animal House.
You fucked up. You trusted us.
I would be happy with that answer. You know, at least it would be honest, you know? Yeah. And I think there's some points for that. You talk about being responsible means taking ownership of the experience and problems, helping achieve the customer's desired outcome, and caring for your customer's well-being. How are some companies able to thread that needle?
I think actually this is probably the area where I think we see the biggest problem at the moment.
So it's not just me.
No. I think this kind of lack of ownership and this lack of responsibility is really threading its way actually right through society, frankly. And I think that's coming through into customer experience. It goes back to this point of, you know, is the customer always right or is the customer probably wrong? And we just want them to kind of get on with it. You know, I saw a great example the other day, one of the big water companies here in the UK, someone sent a tweet to them saying, I've just spotted a leak on this road in this town. I thought I'd let you know. The company replied back and said, thank you. You can go on our website to check if we already know about this. And if not, you can then log it so that an engineer will come and visit. And that was like the official reply, which was basically just putting all this effort back onto the customer.
And that was helpful feedback somebody was providing to the water company.
Yeah, they didn't
have to do it. It's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. They should have just gone, great, thanks. We'll take that on. We'll look into it. We'll see if we can do it. So this lack of responsibility we see quite a lot at the moment. There's a company called AO.com, and in the UK they do white goods. Retailer, so you know, selling fridges, washing machines, etc., and delivering them. Wonderful organization, huge empowerment and freedom within the team, and they only have two rules as part of their customer experience strategy, which is treat everyone in the way you'd want your grandma to be treated, and make decisions that would make your mum proud.
Yes,
and that's it. That's it. And I love that. And I particularly love the second one because John Roberts, the CEO, he gives great empowerment, like I say, to his team. And you go, would my mum be proud of the decision I'm making? And more often than not, your mum will be proud if you take ownership, you take responsibility, I think, not that you just kind of brush your hands of it. And we need to get more of that thinking back into individuals and organizations that we've got responsibility here. Customers pay us. We only exist because customers pay us and because customers choose to use us. And we need to start taking that ownership and responsibility again.
Oh, it's so powerful and it's so missing. Let's jump to straightforward in our remaining time here. Page 130, you write, the most human companies are those that are the most straightforward to deal with. And being straightforward to deal with is perhaps the most important behavior of all those that could deliver a human customer experience. And of course, there's big implications for all the marketing people, creating content and sales, but talk about the power of being straightforward.
Yeah, language is so important here. So important, you know. There's one element of straightforward, which is, you know, are you just a straightforward organization generally, you know, in that you just kind of see things as they are and talk in a common sense way. But the language element is so important here, particularly if you're in a regulated environment. It's so easy to write communications and speak in jargon.
Yes, and to let the legal team basically write it.
What do you know what it's that? It's letting the legal team write it, but it's actually you just become used to it. Organizations, people in organizations see the world from the inside out.
Yes.
You know, I used to work in banking for 12 years, and I was probably the most customer-facing person of the people I work with in head office. But even I end up just talking in jargon because you're surrounded by it every day. You start to speak in. I mean, as you said, I worked for HSBC, so the company itself is an acronym. Before you even get into the meetings where you're using, you know, various kind of jargons, like APRs and various savings language and mortgage language and everything else, and you forget. It's called the curse of knowledge in behavioral sciences, you know, as I'm sure you'll know. You forget what it's like not to know. You forget what it's like to be that person buying their first house. You forget what it's like to be that person who's never taken insurance before, who's maybe even never been on a holiday before, who just doesn't know anything. And how you explain that and how you talk about that is what makes it accessible to people, is what makes it straightforward to deal with. But it's so hard to do, you know. And I gave a couple of examples. Citymapper do this brilliantly with the language they use. You know, it's really little things, like, you know, rather than saying loading, they say thinking when their page is going, little things like that, tiny things that humanize it. There's a real estate agency here in London, and we used to have signs up that say for sale or sold if your house is on the market or not, and they changed it to buy me and I'm taken. Just to really, really humanize it, you know, really humanize the language, and it just raises a smile. And actually, yeah, okay, I kind of get that. So, you know, it doesn't have to be jokey things, it can be serious things. But if you really relentlessly look at the language you're using, and that is both the spoken word and the written word, and you start by looking at how you talk about things internally, you know, don't talk about acquisition because no one wants to be acquired. Don't talk about retention because I don't want to be retained. Think about the language. Don't talk about loyalty. Talk about usefulness. Think about the language that you're using internally, because that's the language that will end up coming out externally.
It's like on a website page, when you on a landing page where you fill out the form and there's a call to action. One of the worst words you can put in that call to action is submit.
Nobody wants to submit,
you know?
Yeah, exactly right. The other day I had to fill in I was on a train and I wanted to use the Wi-Fi, and I had to fill in a big long Wi-Fi form, and the first thing it asked me was my gender. And I thought, do you really need to know my gender to be able to access the train Wi-Fi? Like, why is that?
Are there a couple different systems for?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just don't understand what relevance that could have. But no, but that had a star next to it, so I had to answer before I was able to, you know. And it goes back; it's accessible as well. Going back to the start, I had to answer this question before I could get the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, and in the book you talk about how sometimes you have to fill out forms, and sometimes they'll ask you for your title, and you put like the honorable, or like you're an elected official. And it reminded me of the college I went to. Occasionally they'll have an alumni function over the years, and for some reason they have like every possible title, you know, like a general, governor, Mr., Dr., Mrs., and they have one, His Excellency, and I always pick that.
Yeah, definitely. I would be exactly the same.
I don't know what it means, but I always want to see if it shows up on a name tag. So
yeah, that's exactly the same. The only time I got in trouble with that, I think I mentioned this in the book, was when I used counselor.
That's right.
Yeah. I got a response because I was complaining about a problem with the council, and I got a very rapid response saying, I'm really sorry, councillor, for the problems you've had. And then I kind of felt partly guilty and partly like, well, that's probably helped me get a response, actually. But yeah, I'm a big fan of doing that and highlighting the ridiculousness of it all.
Explain what showing the plumbing is. I love this because it brought to mind how many times where I'm given an excuse and I don't care.
Yeah, there's a real balance in organizations between showing transparency of how you work and then just making customers go through hoops that are completely irrelevant to them. I mean, I've always thought bank accounts are a great example of this. Mm-hmm. You know, 16 digit card numbers on your credit card and bank account numbers. And this is all just internal stuff that banks need to know to move the money into the right place. Like, you know, we should by now have a system where I don't need to know the numbers of my bank account at all. I can just have, you know, my spending account and my savings account, and I can just call them John's spending account, John's savings account. And in the background, they can work out how all that money moves around and all these different numbers that have to go. But, you know, you just don't need to see all this plumbing. You don't need to see all the different departments that are involved, all the different people that you need to speak to. And it ends up kind of really slowing things down. It ends up becoming very confusing for customers. And again, it's about taking on that that ownership, making things as simple as possible for customers, only asking them what you need to ask, only getting them involved in where they need to get involved. They don't need to see or have to deal with all the inner workings of your organization. You know, you find it quite a lot if you phone up and someone says, well, I guess it's a bit like when you phone up and people say, you know, unexpectedly high call volumes, or this person's not in today, and you go, well, you need to sort that out. You just need to sort that out. My outcome is I've got this problem. I need to get to the end of it. Your inner workings are not my responsibility. And right. Frankly, I don't really, in a nice way, I don't really care. I just want to get to my outcome. So please let me do that in a way where I don't have to take on all this extra information.
Well, and I think the customer knows that they could solve it. It's making it their problem. One other quick question about that. Explain how over-apologizing can actually have a detrimental effect.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, actually. It's really come up the last 10 years or so with social media. This kind of age of outrage, I suppose, we live in this, this kind of people worried that they're offending people all the time, which needs to be balanced by, you know, being far more reasonable in the way you talk about things as well. But yeah, I think I tell this story of I asked a question of Tesco, the big supermarket here in the UK, on social media. I asked them why they were doing something with one of their new innovations, and the guy replied and said, look, I'm really sorry for any inconvenience caused. And I said, well, there's been absolutely no inconvenience at all. I've just asked you a question. Just give me your answer. Let's just have a conversation about it. And the problem is, you know, so the default answer at the moment is to say sorry. That's a problem because it moves you into parent-child relationships. If you look at transactional analysis,
yes,
relationships, it moves you into parent-child relationship, whereas every relationship works best adult to adult.
Mm-hmm.
But the other problem is then actually it starts to become meaningless. So when you get complaint letters and they just say, I'm sorry for the inconvenience caused, I'm sorry, you just think, well, you're not really sorry. And it just becomes a worthless phrase that's being used versus when you hear a really genuine sorry. I've got an example in the book from 1951 of a really, really genuine apology where people, you're in no doubt of how sorry that person really is for the problem that happened. So it's a problem because it devalues the word, but it's also a problem because it's changing the balance of the relationship to one that isn't really healthy, I don't think.
Yeah, yeah. There are five enablers, which we talked about. We don't have a whole lot of time. I don't want to burn up. I know you've got a cocktail hour at your company that I'm keeping you from.
That's right.
And hopefully you've empowered your employees to start without you. But just in case, let me just ask you about one of the five, and that's the one I mentioned earlier, which is chapter 15. And again, don't tell the other chapters, but this was really my favorite one. And this is just one of the great secrets to success in business, certainly in marketing and sales. John Sills, I don't want to fill your to-do list with things to do, but you could write another entire book about this one chapter because it's so hurting. And you write, staying connected to customers means understanding and immersing in customers' lives, which we've touched upon earlier, using your own product regularly, and staying abreast of relevant changes in the world. And you write, when speaking to and researching the companies in the showcase, companies I mentioned earlier, one common trait overwhelmingly stood out over and above all the others, staying connected to customers. And the next paragraph, you write, this might sound easy, but it is in fact very hard. Why?
I mean, it's the most probably straightforward, basic bit of advice, but it's also the bit of advice that currently is being missed the most. You know, if you're going to run a successful organization, you have to really, really stay close to what really matters to your customers.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen, and it's mainly by accident because most people in organizations are trying to do the right thing, is a real detachment from people in head offices that are designing the experiences and the people, the users, the customers, the real humans who are using the experience. And part of that is about wage inequality, actually. So, it's very difficult now for people that work in senior manager jobs in big businesses to really connect with what's happening, maybe with a large part of the organization. And partly it's just around a lack of actual contact because so much experience now is digital and so many of these surveys and the results come back on PowerPoints and PDFs. What you tend to find is leaders would rather, if they see something they don't like, they'd rather question the methodology than accept the inconvenient truth. You know, they'd rather go, is that the right sample size? Did we speak to the right people? Maybe we asked them at the wrong time and we should have asked them at the weekend. Now, if you want to be really connected with customers, That means, I think, and what I saw with the showcase, is really experiencing things firsthand. We call it customer immersion. You have to go and really immerse with your customers. Spend time with them in their home. Spend with their permission. Spend time with them shopping. Spend time with them, you know, using your own products. Because not only does it give you that real connection, but it also gives you visceral emotional memories that give you conviction to get into action. And I talk about City Mapper. And every time City Mapper move to a new city, they have a thing called the Traveling Circus. They get a cross-section of their team. They move to the city. They live in that city for a month, and they move Airbnb every 2 days. So they get to experience what life's really like traveling through that city over and above just what the data says. Or Chiltern Railways, the highest-rated railway company here in the UK, they insist that their senior managers all live somewhere on the Chiltern Railways line, and they have to get on their own trains every day, and they have to wear their name badges. And a guy called Alan Riley, who was in charge of customer experience there, he said, you know, we do the forums and we do focus groups and we do meet the manager events, but I learn everything I need to know on the 723 from Princess Risborough to London Marylebone. The more formal the forum, the less I learn. So it's going back to basic old school advice. But when you're a startup, you're close to your customers. The bigger the organization gets, the harder it is to stay connected with your customers. And that's where problems come in. So that's the overwhelming advice in the enablers, which are the cultural ways of working in an organization, is to do everything you can to stay connected to what really matters to your customers.
Oh, let me just add to that from page 164. It's only by fully immersing in people's real lives, experiencing firsthand at a human level what really matters to them, that people can reconnect with what's important to customers and have the visceral belief needed to push the organization into a new direction. That means speaking to them, observing them, spending time with them, serving them, and actually being them. And then, I'm sorry, it's just my favorite chapter. I apologize. I plead guilty.
Thanks, but
page 169. When I ask business leaders if they're close to their customers, they always say yes. When I ask when the last time was they spoke to a customer, they usually say they can't remember. When I ask why they don't do it more often, the response is nearly always, I'd love to, but I just don't have time. But if you're running a business that relies on having customers, what on earth are you doing that's more important than speaking to them?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
John Sills, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
It would be very simply, if in doubt, be human. If in doubt, be human. Behave in a human way. Act in a human way. Do what you think the right thing is. If you were just acting like a normal human that we all are, and you probably won't go far wrong. So, yeah, the one thing for me would be, if in doubt, be human.
But, John, that's hard.
It is hard. Being a human is hard, actually.
Yes.
That's why you've got to take my nan's advice and drink more whiskey.
Yes! I already know what I'm doing as soon as this interview is over. Well, let's give the listeners something to do today just to get them thinking about some of the ideas we've talked about, put an idea from the book into action, get them maybe putting pencil to paper, just go do something.
Yeah, I would think the one thing would be what we've just been talking about, actually, around connection. I think really think about what you can do in the next 2, 3, 4 weeks to go and spend some time with real people.
Oh.
So can you go and work in the contact center for a day? Can you go and do some cool listening? Can you just go and mystery shop your own stores or your own products or your competitors' products? Can you just pick up the phone and ring a few of your customers? Can you go and visit a customer? Can you go to a store and just speak to a few people that are there or whatever your business is? You know, find a few ways, and through some of those examples you just shared, Douglas, find a few ways just to spend some real time with real people, crucially without talking about your product or your service. Don't just ask them what they think about you and your product. Just go and find out about them and ask some questions, and you'll be amazed by what you hear back.
Yes, talk about them, and for the love of all things holy, stop talking about yourself and your products. Even for just a moment. Oh, great advice. That is such valuable advice. I can't tell you how many books I've read where they talk about how just doing that gives them such a competitive advantage. And as I often say to the listeners, you don't have to do this perfectly. Just do it a little bit and you're really going to stand out, just to give you a little bit of encouragement and inspiration. So, John, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
It's such an interesting question. It's really, really made me think. I think there's probably three books that were pinpointed in three quite different ways that have done that. The first is a book called The Inner Game of Tennis by a guy called Timothy Gordon.
Oh, I just heard about that.
Yeah, yeah. Which really quite old book now. But I read it quite early on in my career, and it's a very short book, but a brilliant book about coaching, effectively.
Yes.
And what you can learn about how humans behave and how you can coach and how you can manage and essentially how you can perform at a really high level. It's framed all around tennis, but you realize the lessons of it are applicable to so many people. So that one was very important to me early on in my career through coaching and management. Then a book called Where Good Ideas Come From by Stephen Johnson, who's the brilliant writer on innovation. Also wrote a great book called How We Got to Now. They mentioned a book in there about a technique for producing good ideas.
By James Webb Young.
That's exactly right, yeah. Which was really, really important to me when I was starting to really get into design and innovation and creativity. And he's just such a wonderful, wonderful writer as well. The book is just fascinating to listen to. And then the third book is On Writing by Stephen King. Which actually is just a brilliant book anyway. But I just, early on in my career, I was talked about, funnily enough, modeling, but a different kind of modeling, the kind of modeling where you observe what great people do and try and copy it. And I find it fascinating to understand the habits of writers. And Stephen King is one of the greatest and the most productive writers in our generation, at least. And it's a fantastic book about writing and him and his habits. And he really challenges you to do that. And I found that brilliantly useful in the past few years as I've started to get more into writing as well. So I think for three different reasons, they'd be the three books that I would say have inspired different parts of my career.
Very interesting answer. And is this your first book?
This is my first full book. Yeah, I've written some short stories for things, but yeah, this is my first published book. Yeah.
Well, it seemed like a book written by somebody who had already written some books. So
thank you.
And I greatly enjoyed reading it. Your personality came through. Are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or maybe looking forward to reading?
Yeah, they probably are. I mean, you mentioned actually Alchemy by Rory Sutherland. I mean, that's 2 or 3 years old now, but if your listeners haven't read it, I think it's just a brilliant, brilliant book.
That book's going to have such a long shelf life.
Oh, I loved it. I mean, it's for, I'm very tempted to talk about Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, but mm-hmm. I think I read that 90% of people don't actually finish it. So, but it's a very tough book, but a brilliant book. But Alchemy is amazing. I'd recommend that. I'd recommend a book called Humanizing Risk that's literally just come out by a guy called Christian Hunt. And that is, almost a compliment to my book, I think. He's an ex-compliance guy, operational guy, and he talks about how you can bring humanity into compliance and risk management in big organizations, which is a fascinating topic and read. And then the only other one I'd suggest is nothing to do with marketing, but it's called Prisoners of Geography by a guy called Tim Marshall, where he explains the politics of the world by the geography of the world. And it's one of those books that really kind of you read it and you suddenly realize everything you thought you knew was completely wrong, and the predictability of politics actually based on the geography of the world. So it's a fascinating book. A fascinating book.
Prisoners of Geography, 10 maps that explain everything about the world.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And the follow-up actually as well, The Power of Geography, is also really great.
I see them all here. Have you ever heard of a book called The Customer Copernicus?
Yeah, I have. To my business partner, Charlie Dawson, wrote that. So you're right, I should have mentioned that. So in the foundation, so Charlie set the company up and I joined many years ago. So 2 years ago, Charlie wrote a book called The Customer Copernicus, which is how to create a customer-led business. And I guess the way our books interact is Charlie's book is kind of from the top down, looking at culture and leadership and organizations that have grown and been there and done it and how they kind of lost it. And I guess my book's a bit more from the bottom up, from the customer experience, from what you're doing with your customers, and they nicely meet in the middle, which is handy for us from a business perspective.
Well, I knew that you'd heard of it because you mentioned it a few times in the book.
Yeah.
But is that one as good as yours?
I absolutely think it is. That's a very difficult question.
I'm trying to get you in trouble because I know you're going to the cocktail hour. Yeah,
you are. Yeah, exactly. Which I can say, and as to reassure you, they are very empowered, the team. They are very much enjoying themselves with my whiskey at the moment.
Yes, a tribute to their management. So, if that guy ever does interviews, I mean, that looked like a really interesting book. And I know a guy who interviews authors of new marketing and sales books. And now, let's be honest. He's not the brightest bulb on the chandelier, but his guests are really phenomenal. So, you know, I'd actually heard about that book. And you know what? I looked all through I don't have it. And I remember thinking, you know what? Somebody probably contacted me about that and said, hey, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, can you send me a copy? And then it's about happens half the time. For some reason, it never shows up. But, see what you think. I don't need an answer right away like the emergency room did. See what you think definitely. Of this interview. And maybe he can listen to it and decide if he wants his reputation to take a hit by being on the Marketing Book Podcast. So,
I think we have to do this because then you can really be the judge of which book's better. You'll be the independent auditor. So, let's definitely do that.
So we could then, have like the Foundation founder throwdown and like a celebrity death match.
Our own cage fight. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Ooh, I like it. Like you, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg want to do. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm not sure how well that's going to go for Elon Musk, but who am I to, tell him what to do? So, well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, your company site, your personal site, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. Dear listener, please reach out in some way to John and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Congratulate him on the book. Let him know if you learned something from the interview. He already said he hasn't heard from a lot of people, and I think he'd like to hear from you. So, and also, guests on the show have told me that they really do enjoy hearing from Marketing Book podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are
really, really, really ridiculously good looking.
And if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now, unless you're driving. Please don't do it while you're driving. And clicking on this episode's website link. The book is The Human Experience, How to Make Life Better for Your Customers and Create a More Successful Organization. The author is John Sills. John, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm off to listen to the Human League for the rest of the evening now.
Goodbye, Tin Man.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."